Rourke steered the Harley-Davidson lowrider toward the bridge. The buildings coming up on his right were gray factory smokestacks from light industry. Rourke's Harley was halfway across the bridge now, and from the elevation he could look beyond the largely flat roof lines and into the town, and beyond that into the gray-seeming desert. There was no sign of life. Rourke had to tack the Harley into the winds to keep their buffeting effect from flipping the big bike down. Three quarters of the way across the bridge, he angled right, trying to keep quartering into the wind as he did, heading the bike down and onto the off-ramp into the town. He could only imagine that Rubenstein was having greater problems handling the heavy winds. As Rourke's Harley dipped below the level of the bridge, he swerved slightly left, then straightened out. He cut a lazy figure eight in the street, fronting it as he scouted in both directions, then headed right from the direction he'd come and into the town itself. The main street seemed some two blocks ahead, Rourke gauged. Reaching the main street, Rourke cut a gentle arc in the large intersection. He settled his sunglasses and swept the CAR-15 muzzle away from the bike and into the empty street.
It looks like everyone just vanished.
I've got a bad feeling about this place.
Could it have been a neutron bomb?
Now, what would a nice young lady like you know about neutron bombs? Nah, it couldn't have been. Those trees growing over there are still healthy. Everybody just left, or mostly everybody at least.
Where's Paul?
That's just what I was starting to ask myself. Might not be a bad idea, you know, for you to take my gun belt and put that python on yourself. You might need the spare ammo on the belt.
Rourke felt the woman's hands and arms encircle his waist. He helped her undo the buckle, then craned his neck and watched her as she slung the cami-patterned gun belt from her right shoulder across to her left hip, the python in its flap holster on her left side, butt forward.
You ready?
Yes.
Okay. Did you just see something moving in that space between buildings about 25 yards back?
On the right?
Yeah.
Man with a rifle, I thought, but I wasn't sure.
Yeah, okay. I'm going up to the end of the block here and turn down and back into that secondary street Paul was supposed to come up. That's when we should hit it.
The secondary street was coming up on the left, and as Rourke's eyes scanned back and forth, there was still no sign of Paul Rubenstein. He pulled the Harley into another wide arc, cutting left into the secondary street. As they cruised slowly down the street, on each side of them now, armed men and women were appearing, stepping from around corners, from behind overturned cars and trucks, closing in like a wall behind them.
John!
Yeah, I see him. Relax. If they wanted to shoot first, they'd be doing it by now.
I don't take much comfort from that. My God, look up ahead! They've got Paul!
Yeah, I see it.
Rubenstein was on his knees at the end of the street, his hands tied out. Arms stretched between the rear axle of an overturned truck and a support column for one of the smaller factory loading docks. It was a young man standing beside Rubenstein, an assault rifle with fixed bayonet in his hands, the point of the bayonet at the side of Rubenstein's throat.
John! Go back!
Rourke's eyes scanned the knot of young men and women, all of them armed. He had counted, including the ones walled behind him now and blocking his way out, perhaps 25, more or less evenly divided male and female, and all of them in their middle to late teens.
Who are you people?
We'll ask the questions.
Then ask away, boy.
Who are you?
John T. Rourke. The girl here says she's Natalie Timmons, and that man your pal has on the ground there is Paul Rubenstein. We're just wayfaring strangers.
Who are you with?
You don't listen too good, do you, boy?
I mean, what group are you with?
Well, I belonged to a motor club before the war. That do you any good?
Cut out the smartass routine, mister.
Boy, you talk that way to me once more, and you're gonna get an extra navel. Now, what are you doing with my friend here?
You came to steal from us, didn't you?
What? No! If you've got something I want, I'll deal with you for it. If I find something that's just sitting there and doesn't seem to belong to anyone, yeah, I'll take it. Money, checks, and credit cards aren't much good these days, I understand.
Well, we call ourselves the Guardians.
Well, good for you. What are you the Guardians of?
Rourke, behind us. Six of them coming.
We're the Guardians of—
You ask me, I think you're crazies myself. Now hold on. How many of you have marks on your faces like he has? Or elsewhere on your bodies.
A girl stepped forward out of the knot around the leader. Rourke saw acne-like marks on both her cheeks and neck, identical to those that he now recognized on the boy. The six advancing from behind Rourke were getting closer, and he could see the marks on their faces out of the corner of his left eye as well.
Who are you?
We've already covered that. Where were you the night of the war?
Were we anywhere near a blast site, you mean?
We were, and we know what we've got. But Guardian here is what we do.
We were away on a senior class field trip. But by the time the bus ran out of gas, and we walked back here, everyone had gone. We knew where there were some guns, and we've been running the town ever since. We know we've all got radiation sickness and that we're all dying, but we're guarding the town until our families get back. We're doing this for them.
What if they don't come back?
We'll guard the town until the last of us has died.
Anybody with sores like that is gonna die. And soon. And painfully.
We know.
John.
I know.
What do you want us for? Let my friend go and we'll be on our way.
People like you, violent people, people without a home or a town, you caused the war. You deserve to die.
If you feel that way, then you are crazy.
Rourke was watching the leader now. But out of the corner of his eye, he saw the young man guarding Rubenstein take a half step back, drawing the bayonet rifle rearward for a thrust.
John!
I'm sorry.
Rourke's CAR-15 cut down the boy with a bayonet before he could pierce Rubenstein's throat. His left hand snatched one of the Detonic's 45. The slug caught the leader between the eyes and hurtled the already dying youth back against the knot of followers behind him. Natalie shot off the bike and fell into a crouch, the python in both her fists, firing into the six attackers coming up behind them. Rourke slipped his Detonic into his trouser belt, grabbing with his left hand for his black chrome Sting 1A. As he reached Rubenstein, he hacked out with the double-edged blade, cutting the ropes on Rubenstein's left wrist, then the right, tossing the younger man the once-fired 45.
They're only kids, John!
God help me, I know that, damn it!
Three of the heavily armed youths were rushing toward Rourke, and he swung the CAR-15 online. Rourke glanced back to Rubenstein, who was back on his feet, running towards his bike. 20 yards away, Natalie was reloading the python, and as she brought it online, with her left hand, she brushed the hair back from her face. For an instant, Rourke wasn't in the middle of a life-or-death gun battle with a gang of bloodthirsty kids all dying of radiation poisoning. He was back in Latin America. The gun she held wasn't a python, it was an SMG. And the hair was blonde, but the gesture, the stance, the set of the eyes, they hadn't been blue in those days, was exactly the same. Rourke turned, seeing Rubenstein firing the German MP-40, Schmeisser, into the dirt at the feet of three attackers. The youths kept coming, and the reluctance was visible in the way Rubenstein moved. Rourke watched as the younger man raised the muzzle of the SMG towards their upper bodies. Rourke's eyes scanned the area around him, the muzzle of his CAR-15 sweeping the air. There were bodies, but no living combatants. He counted 10 dead, meaning at least 15 still out there somewhere.
I was beginning to think you were never going to make your move. I think I realized before you did that they were all dying of radiation sickness. What is it?
I remembered where I saw you. South America, a few years ago. You were a blonde. I think your eyes were green, but it was you. Contact lenses?
They were contact lenses. But what now?
You mean about this, or about my remembering you?
Whatever.
Let's stick to this for now. We can worry about the other thing later. We still need supplies. Looks like the town was abandoned for some reason. Probably, if we look hard enough, we can find what we need. Still gotta worry about those kids sniping at us, too.
I can't understand this. Does this strike anyone else as being horribly, horribly wrong?
What?
We just killed 10 kids. What's happening?
Sometimes when people realize they're dying, it's almost as if they step out of themselves. Those kids were smart enough to realize what was happening to them. And they focused their energies, their thoughts, everything on guarding this town. Kind of a calculated mass hysteria. It didn't matter to them that it was wholly irrational or impossible. It didn't even matter that they knew I was right, that no one was coming back here for them. Probably once the first one started noticing what was happening and then some of the others started coming up with the symptoms, they just made sort of a pact. Kids are big on that sort of thing. Pacts, blood oaths.
But that radiation poisoning thing, just because they were in the wrong spot at the wrong time, it could have been us instead.
It still could be. When was the last time you checked the Geiger counter?
Damn, Rourke. Sometimes I like it better when you don't say anything.
Rourke sat by the small Coleman stove, water still steaming from the yellow kettle, the red foil Mountain House package in his left hand, a tablespoon he'd found held in his right. He scooped a spoonful of the contents up and put it in his mouth, then leaned back against the rear bumper of the pickup truck.
I love beef stroganoff.
This stuff is terrific.
What have you got there, Paul?
Chicken and rice.
Next time, try some of this. The noodles in it are great, too.
Well, now that we've found food, plenty of water, gasoline, and a four-wheel drive pickup, what next?
Now, don't forget we found cigars for me and cigarettes for you.
That guy really had a lot of stuff put away into that warehouse.
Yeah, too bad he never had a chance to use it, apparently.
I can't understand that town. Why hadn't the gangs been there?
Well...
And where did all the people who lived there go?
The way I figured it, everybody in town just evacuated. I don't know where. When those kids showed up and started shooting everything that moved, I guess the lead elements of the brigand force probably pulled in there, got killed, and never reported back. There are two kinds of field commanders. Whoever's in charge of the gangs apparently isn't the kind of guy who took losing a squad of men as a personal challenge. He just went around the town, maybe figuring the people there were too well armed. That means he's smart. He's not out to conquer and hold territory. He's just out to keep his people going on whatever they can plunder. I figure right about now he's got a dicey job. Could be several hundred of them, no discipline, drinking up everything they can get their hands on and staying smashed most of the time on drugs. Be like trying to control a gang of alcoholic gorillas. Or maybe more like some stereotypical Vikings. Come in and strike hard, earn a reputation for brutality, retreat or withdraw fast, and steal everything that isn't nailed down.
Then they're still ahead of us?
Yeah, and strong, and probably by now spoiling for a good fight. Oh, I wouldn't worry. We're bound to bump into them. Hey, Paul, chuck this trash in the back of the truck for me.
Why go to all that trouble?
Why, you mean why not just throw it on the ground? Because enough of the country's ruined. Why ruin more of it? So, Natalie, am I starting to ring bells for you? Can you remember me yet?
I don't know what you mean.
When do we all have a drink? I mean, I could use one. We got 6 bottles back in the truck. Where'd you put them, John?
There, just in front of my bike. I wrapped them up in an old towel I found. Go get one if you want.
Rourke glanced away from the girl and toward the truck. They'd found the warehouse just as darkness had fallen, and Rubenstein, good at finding things, Rourke decided, had uncovered the doorway leading into the small basement under the main floor of the place. Using one of the flashlights they'd taken a long time back from the geological supply shop in Albuquerque, Rourke had gone down and discovered the cache of supplies. All the ammunition had been .308, and Rourke had left it, not having need of additional ammo for the Steyr. But the vast supplies of Mountain House freeze-dried foods, water, and gasoline had been welcome. They had taken comparatively little, resealing the door after themselves just in case the original owner was still alive. They'd found the pickup truck a half hour earlier, and with the added supplies, decided on taking it along. The keys had been in it. The girl had been left on guard outside the warehouse while Rourke and Rubenstein had done the loading, the most awkward thing being getting the Harleys aboard the truck and securing them. There had been no further signs of the doomed, insane guardians they had confronted earlier. They'd driven back into the desert in silence and darkness. The pickup's headlights didn't go on once as Rourke headed slowly along the road, and after several miles turned off into the desert, nothing more than moonlight lighting his way. He'd walked back along the route and carefully obliterated their tire treads from the sand. The best drink of my life. It wasn't long before the rigors of the day and the drink had their effect on Rubenstein. Rourke alternately watched the stars overhead and stared at his watch. As he watched the glowing tip of his second cigar, already burnt to nearly a stump in his fingers, he turned to Rubenstein. The man slept with a 3/4 empty bottle clutched tight in his hands.
I must trust you.
Why do you say that?
I must trust you because otherwise I wouldn't let myself get drunk around you. You will have to promise me that if I start to talk, you won't listen. I mean, if I say anything personal or something.
Whatever.
Natalia leaned in toward him.
There, Mr. Goody Goody. That didn't hurt, did it?
No, it didn't hurt. Problem is, it felt too good.
Rourke put the cigar butt on the ground and ground it out with the heel of his boot, folding the girl into his left arm and letting her head sink against his chest. He could feel her breathing, slow and even against him. He looked up at the stars, the warmth of the woman in his arms only heightening his loneliness. He wondered what was out there among them. Was there another world where men and women hadn't been foolish enough to destroy everything as it was now destroyed here? Rourke closed his eyes. As Sarah Rourke straightened in the saddle, she thought of her son Michael and the last few days since she had drunk the contaminated water and been rendered virtually helpless. The boy was a constant source of amazement to her. Lying virtually helpless on her back at that time, the stomach cramps, the nausea, Michael had been her hands and her feet, keeping the girls and himself fed, even feeding and watering the horses. Once there had been noises, voices from far along on the other side of the forested area from where they were, and the boy had brought her the .45 automatic pistol, then gathered the girls next to him and waited silently beside her until the voices had died away and the noise ceased. She turned now in the saddle, still awkwardly because of her stiffness, and looked at the boy.
You're the finest son anyone could want, Michael.
Thanks. Why do you say that, Mom?
I just want to. It's just something I need you to know.
Rourke squinted into the morning sunlight despite the dark aviator-style sunglasses he wore. His face and his body under his clothes were bathed in sweat. He shifted the CAR-15's web sling off his shoulder, the outline of the sling visible in dark, wet stains on his shirt. He had cut across country, backtracking for a while until he had come across the lead elements of the paramilitary force. With his liberated field glasses, he had spotted the familiar face of the officer he and Rubenstein had encountered days earlier by the abandoned truck trailer when they had been resupplying with ammunition. The force consisted of what Rourke estimated as close to 350 men, traveling in trucks and jeeps in a ragged wedge formation along the road, outriders on dirt bikes paralleling their movements and working back and forth up and down the convoy line like herders moving cattle or sheep. He timed them and judged they were making approximately 50 miles per hour, and with their numbers, there was no reason to suppose they wouldn't press on for 15 or more hours per day, as long as daylight lasted. Rourke had cut ahead then, the convoy several hours behind where he had left Paul Rubenstein and the girl who called herself Natalie. And now, as he watched the road below him, the tight bend the highway followed, he could see the brigands. There were more than two dozen long-haul 18-wheeler trucks at their center, traveling four abreast, consuming the entire highway space. Squads of motorcycle riders in front and in back and on the shoulders, all heavily armed. Though he had no way of telling what or who might be inside the trucks, he judged the strength of the brigand force at better than 400 men and women. For some reason he couldn't fathom, they were heading back in the direction of Van Horn, speed approximately 50 miles per hour. A smile crossed Rourke's lips, but vanished just as quickly. As he watched, the column began turning off the road, moving single file and heading into the desert.
Ah, shit.
Rourke lowered his field glasses and stared down into his hands. The change of direction into the desert would keep the brigands ahead of him, and the paramilitary force was still behind him. Rourke reslung the CAR-15 on his right shoulder. The vehicle's turning had forced his hand, he realized, and any way he decided to go, the odds for staying alive were dropping. As Rourke pulled the Harley up the grade into the sheltered campsite where the truck was parked, he spotted Rubenstein sitting by the Coleman stove, a cup of coffee in both hands, his glasses off. Beyond Rubenstein, he saw Natalie standing by the front of the truck.
Wow, Paul. I didn't recognize you without your glasses. What's with Natalie?
What? Oh, I don't know. She's been that way ever since she woke up and found you were gone.
So what'd you find out, Rourke?
You look cheerful this morning. What I found out was that the paramilitary is a few hours behind us with a large force. The gang is a few hours ahead of us with a large force, even larger than the paramils. If we bump into the paramils, we've had it. Paul and I had a run-in with one of their patrols before we bumped into you. The officer who commanded the patrol is with the paramil force I saw. If he spots us, we'll get shot, and probably you too, since you're with us. They're southwest of us now, heading northeast along the road. The gang was heading southwest, and for a while I thought they'd run into the paramils, but they turned off into the desert. probably going to be staying in this area for a while.
So what do we do?
Can't go southwest and run into the paramills. Just have to take our chances with the gang.
But if we run into them, what then?
Well, we sort of promised that woman with the refugees that we'd look for that blonde guy who killed her baby. I guess we can do that, then move on.
How many of them were there?
Better than 400, I make it. But we can't just stay here. The paramills will find us. I figure that within the next few days, both units should lock horns. Looks unavoidable with their sizes. They couldn't miss one another. And maybe we can get clear of the area.
But what do we do until that happens?
Just stay shy of the brigands and try to pass around them, if we can. If we can't, though, we only have one additional option. We join them.
Wait, what?
They've never seen us. They must have picked up a lot of their force from bikers drifting in, two or three at a time. If we have to, we'll fake it.
And what if they don't buy that?
Then we buy the farm.
Samuel Chambers squinted against the yellow lamplight from the desk. His necktie was at half-mast, his suit coat gone, and there were two empty packs of cigarettes crumpled on the small table beside his chair next to a glass ashtray overflowing with cigarette butts. He glanced at his watch. The conference had gone on longer than he expected without breaking. The thought came to him that if this was what being President of the United States was really like, he could see why the job had aged all the men who had gone before him. Chambers looked at the notes he'd taken on the yellow legal pad on his lap, pondering silently if it would work, if the country could be sewn back together even temporarily. Parts of Louisiana and all of Texas had been consolidated into one martial law district, with the paramilitary commander, Soames, taking charge of internal matters. They had no choice but to rely on him, despite the fact that Chambers didn't like the man and trusted him less, due to the sheer numbers of his force and the capability to recruit more. The Air Force Colonel Darlington would use his troops and the Navy forces to handle border defense, using the stores of National Guard supplies to help with this. The National Guard unit, small, would function as a traditional army unit, but outside the borders of this colonel of a nation. They would execute clandestine military operations against the Soviet invaders as required, but more important, try to establish communications links with civil and military authorities in other parts of the country. Chambers smiled bitterly. He was too much of a realist to assume there were not other men now calling themselves President of the United States, or at least taking on the concomitant authority the title implied. He tried telling himself, convincing himself, that it would work. When dawn came, he would be taking a military flight into Galveston to personally assess rumors of a Soviet presence there, as well as to wrap up his personal affairs. All his advisors had warned against the flight. Perhaps, he reflected, that was the first time he had actually felt like a president. He had listened carefully, asked questions, explained his reasoning, and then, in the face of the irrefutable logic of his advisors, flatly stated he didn't give a damn. He wanted to see Galveston one more time, regardless of the consequences.
Heavy lies the head.
Rourke hadn't caught the name of the town as he, Natalie, and Rubenstein had passed it. There was smoke trailing in a wide black line across the sky from where the town should have been, and Rourke thought silently that it was likely the town was no longer there. The brigands had turned back out of the desert early that morning, placing Rourke, Rubenstein, and the girl sandwiched between them and the paramills, now perhaps a day's march or less apart. Rourke braked the light blue pickup truck on the top of a rise, out of years of driving habit, pulling onto the shoulder and out of the main northeastern-bound lanes, despite the fact that there was no traffic. He stretched out after the long ride, watching the dark clouds moving in from the northwest. Already, the breeze, which had been hot that morning, was turning cool, and he shivered slightly as he stared over the guardrail toward the remains of the town. Below the level of the smoke, there were large dust clouds from vehicles, many of them, Rourke reflected. Are they down there?
Yeah, Paul. They're down there, all right. And I make it the paramills aren't far behind us. I think it's now or never.
How about never?
Rourke's right. We're better off with the gang than caught between them and the paramilitaries.
Let's go down, then, and introduce ourselves. Natalie, take my gun belt.
You want me armed again?
Yeah, might be advisable. You seemed to do pretty well with that python last time. There's such messing with success.
Natalia rebuckled the Ranger leather belt and slung it diagonally across her body. The holster, with the 6-inch metallified .357 Magnum revolver hanging on her left side by her hip bone. The dump pouches with the spare ammo crossing her chest between her breasts. As Rubenstein checked his MP40 beside him, Rourke shifted his shoulders under the weight of the twin Detonic stainless 45s and the double Alessi shoulder rig.
Rourke, over there!
Rourke glanced back down the road and to his left. In the distance, in what must have been an athletic field, he could see a crude circle of semi-trailer trucks and several dozen motorcycles, all moving slowly, dust filling the air around them. What the hell are they doing?
I think I know.
They've apparently gotten their mass executions into some kind of ritual, working themselves up into a frenzy before they do them, terrifying the victims, too.
Why are they slowing down?
Guess they're ready for their number.
I didn't think there were so many crazy people in the world.
Some people, maybe most people, can't handle violence emotionally. They sort of revert to savages, and along with that goes all the rest of it.
It's the reptilian portion of the brain coming to the fore. A lot of work was done on it just before the war. The reptile portion of the brain is the part obsessed with ritual and violence. Sometimes there's little to differentiate between the two. Just look at normal things. Fraternity initiations, street gangs, all sorts of things like that. The violence and the ritual eventually so intermingle that you can't have one without the other. Usually one causes the other.
Like rape, Paul, or sex-related murders. Is intercourse or death the purpose of the act, or just something that happens as a result, the act itself being the purpose?
I think Behavioral Psych 101 just let out, gang.
Natalia unholstered the big python and Rubenstein pulled back the bolt on his MP40.
Be cool, guys.
In front of the hood were perhaps 50 people, mostly women and children, with a few older men, some of them still in pajamas or nightgowns, their clothes torn, their faces dirty, and their eyes filled with terror.
This must be the place.
The knot of townspeople stared at Rourke as he emerged from the vehicle, his CAR-15 slung under his right shoulder, with his other hand clutching his pistol grip. They seemed almost as though they collectively made one frightened organism. He looked away from them, rolling the cigar in the corner of his mouth, his chin jutting forward, his legs slightly apart. He turned and looked behind the pickup truck. Already, perhaps a dozen or more of the motorcyclists from the gang were walking toward him. Some of the drivers of the 18-wheelers were climbing down from their cabs and walking toward him as well. Rourke squinted against the sun and shot a glance skyward. The entire northwestern quadrant was so gray it almost seemed black by contrast to the deep blue of the sky above him. The tall man that approached Rourke was his height or better, but an easy 50 pounds heavier, wearing a dark blue denim shirt with the sleeves cut off, leaving frayed edges across his rippling shoulder muscles. He wore a military-style shoulder holster, a stag-gripped .45 automatic riding in it on the left side of his chest. In his right hand was a riot shotgun with extension magazine and a sling, web-materialed, blowing now slightly in the wind like a man's dark, greasy-looking hair. Out of the corner of his left eye, Rourke could see Rubenstein, standing half inside the cab of the pickup truck, the MP40 submachine gun held lazily in his left hand across the roof of the cab. The girl was already out of the pickup truck, standing beside Rourke and a little behind him.
Who the fuck are you?
Rourke. He's Paul Rubenstein. The girl's name is Natalie.
Goddamn names don't mean shit to me, man. What do you want here?
Got the paramils after us. We hit a truck back a ways and boosted some ammo and stuff. Killed a couple of their guys getting away. I figured you might be able to use a few extra people who could handle a gun. You got those suckers less than a day behind you, and you guys leave plenty of tracks.
We got enough people can handle a gun, buddy. What the hell we need you for?
You're amateurs. I'm professional. I'm worth at least any 3 or 4 of you guys.
Bullshit. I'm gonna kill me these little pieces of scared dog shit behind you. Then we'll just see how good you are. Get the hell out of my way.
You know, you guys are real assholes.
What did you just say?
Go ahead. From here, I can't miss. See, you guys keep knocking off the civilian population. After a while, no matter how many of them you kill, they're gonna finally just get mad enough to band together and come after you guys. Then you'll have them and the paramils on your neck. Same thing happened to the Romans. 2,000 years later, it happened to the Nazis when they marched into the Ukraine and Russia. How would you like snipers behind every rock, explosives under every bridge? It can happen to you,
friend.
What do you want? I'm asking again.
I told you, me and my friends want to join up for the duration.
You're as good as any three of us, huh?
Easily.
This man is named Rourke. He claims he's some kind of lousy professional. As good as any three of us. I need two men to help me show him different.
You
want to pick him?
You the head honcho around here?
Yeah, I'm your leader. You backing that?
No, nothing like that. I was just wondering if you had your replacement picked yet.
But my...
Not in front of the lady.
If Rourke wins, he and his people can join us and we let all them over there go and everything. But if he don't, then we kill him and the other guy and the little piece they got with him. After we have some fun with her first, huh?
You picking him, or am I?
Hey, I'll pick.
Be quick about it, huh? I don't feel like standing around in the rain all day waiting for you. Guns, knives, what?
We fight barehanded around here. Taco, Clagger, up here now! Everybody back off and give us some room.
What's your name? I don't like fighting somebody if I don't know his name.
Mike.
I've got a son named Mike. He's tougher than you, though.
Hey, Hooch. Hold on to my baby for me.
Natalie. The girl caught Rourke's CAR-15 in both hands, moving the sling onto her right shoulder, and then diagonally across her body, the pistol grip settling in her comparatively tiny right fist. He slipped off the shoulder rig and both guns together and handed it to Rubenstein, who stood directly next to him.
Hey, Paul. If I die, I will those to you.
Already, the gang leader, Mike, was stripping the denim shirt from his body. The muscles on his arms and chest and neck wet with sweat, rippling even in the greenish light that now seemed heavy on the air itself. Rourke stripped off his own light blue shirt, palming the Sting 1A and dropping it in his jeans jacket. Natalia reached out her left hand and took the shirt.
Clagger here, he used to be an instructor in unarmed combat in the Marine Corps a few years back. Now Taco is kind of special. Made his living ever since he was a kid as a bar fighter down in Mexico. See all them scars? Me, I did time once for killing a man once with my hands. I just crushed his skull with him.
Well then, I'll try and make you fellas look good so you don't get too embarrassed by all of this.
Get him!
The wiry guy called Taco, and then Clagger, bigger than the gang leader, started forward. Slow, unhurried, relaxed-looking. Rourke waited. Clagger feigned a low kick, then wheeled, his left fist flashing outward. But already Rourke had sidestepped, wheeling, his left foot cutting in low, catching Clagger on the right side and knocking him off balance. Rourke sidestepped again, a solid right coming at him from the one called Taco. The blow glanced off the side of Rourke's head, stunning him, driving him back. As Taco followed with a left hook, Rourke blocked it with his right, smashing his own left in a short arm blow to the solar plexus, then crossing his right into the left side of Taco's nose. He followed with his left foot into Taco's crotch. Out of the corner of his eye, Rourke could see Clagger back on balance and rushing toward it. Rourke wheeled, feigning another low kick, then sidestepped fast to his left, lashing out with his right and then left hand. As Clagger stumbled back, Mike drove toward Rourke, knocking him back and off his feet. The man's huge hands went for Rourke's neck, and he smashed his right knee upward, hammering against Rourke's right thigh, then going for Rourke's crotch. Rourke hooked his right thumb in the left corner of Mike's mouth. As Mike's head started pulling away, Rourke freed his left fist and crossed Mike's jaw with a short jab. He rolled away and pulled himself to his feet, then smashed the toe of his right combat boot forward into Mike's teeth. Rourke's right hand held the man by the hair. Clagger started for Rourke again, and Rourke stepped back. Taco was up, his nose a mass of blood streaming down over his mouth and onto his bare, sweating chest. Both men edged slowly toward Rourke. Clagger made his move, sending a wielding series of punches and kicks which Rourke backed off of. Rourke shot forward, blocking a side hammer blow from Clagger's left, then smashing his own left down into the exposed left kidney, then jamming his left foot upward into Clagger's crotch. He dropped his left hand in a straight-edge classic karate chop, slashing across the left side of Clagger's neck. Taco was already coming at Rourke, throwing out his left fist. Taco's right crossed up toward Rourke's face, but he dodged it.
You know how some guys... have a glass jaw? Me?
I'm just the opposite.
Tucker's left flashed forward again, and Rourke let it come, dodging his head right just before impact. He straight-armed Tucker with his own left fist, then crossed with his right, then his left, then his right, hammering the man back. Rourke threw a knee, connecting with Tucker's jaw. Rourke stepped away as Mike climbed to his feet, his lower lip split wide.
Bastard.
Rourke lashed out with his left foot, catching Mike square in the face over the nose.
Natalie!
Rourke watched as the CAR-15 sailed from her right hand and toward him.
Wait! I've been thinking, maybe you don't like to kill. So I got one more test. Same stakes. You make it this time. You're in. I don't think you're gonna make it, but you got my word.
You better hope I do. I'm a doctor, and if somebody doesn't put some stitches into that lower lip of yours, you're gonna bleed to death.
I want you to brace Deke. With guns.
Who's Deke?
He's my right-hand man. He's so good with a piece, you wouldn't believe your eyes.
Where is he?
Right here!
Rourke slowly turned to his right. There was a slim, blonde-haired man with a little imperial on his chin, pansy blue eyes, standing at the edge of the circle of brigands. Rourke's mind flashed back to the description the refugee woman had given of the man who'd shot her baby. This was him. On his right hip, in a cutaway, Hollywood-style fast-draw rig, was a glinting, nickel-plated, single-action revolver, the hammer spur built up, the butt canted rearward, muzzle forward. A heavy leather glove covered the man's left hand. Rourke knew the drill. He'd tried competitive fast draw, had had good friends who'd competed in the sport, and he knew the light speed draws that a trained fast draw man could make.
You on it now, or you want to clean up so you make a good looking corpse?
Catch in five.
As Rourke stood by the cab of the pickup truck, Rubenstein tried to look casual, with the MP-40 subgun in his hands, the bolt still locked open, just waiting for a touch of the trigger. Rourke could feel Natalie's hands on his back, a handkerchief or something in her one hand, and cool water being rubbed across him. He splashed water on his chest as well. Then took his shirt and started to dry himself with it. He pulled it on over his head. Natalia was still beside him, daubing with the wet rag at the right side of his mouth where he'd been cut.
I'm fine.
You're not really going to do this. I mean, you're good with guns and all, but this is like apples and oranges.
You don't think maybe she's right, do you, John?
You mean, can I outdraw Deke? I don't think so, but there's a difference between drawing down on a timer and drawing down on a man. We'll see what happens.
I've seen that kind of shooting before.
Yeah, so have I. He holds his hand on the gun butt, his left hand edged in front of the holster, and on the signal he rocks the gun out of the leather. The hand with the gun slaps the hammer back, fans it, and the gun goes off. I couldn't see whether he's got the trigger tied back or not, so he doesn't have to bother touching it.
He probably does. You want your python back?
No. I'll stick with my Detonics. They've done me right so far.
Rourke reached into the cab, taking the Alessi double shoulder rig and the twin 45s.
Rourke, you're crazy. You can't match that kind of speed with a conventional gun.
These aren't conventional guns. Faster lock time than a standard 45, less felt recoil, good trigger pulls, the whole bit. Grip safeties are deactivated.
That doesn't have an ambidextrous safety. How will it do you any good to have a cocked and loaded gun in your left hand?
Well, that's the advantage of having big hands. Hopefully, it'll only take one in any case.
You are crazy, Rourke. You're going to get us all killed. All those people.
You know you're a funny girl. You use a gun better than most men. You're pro all the way. You know your stuff. And like I said, I remember you. Different hair, contacts for a different eye color. I know who you are, why you are out there in the desert. And I know you and I are going to bump heads sooner or later. And you know it too. But you seem to genuinely care about those people over there, like you did with the refugees back down the road. And even though I know you know we're on opposite sides, really, I honestly think you care what happens to me. Maybe I got problems going out there and facing Deke, but I think you've got problems right there in your heart. And you know just what I mean, lady.
Remember that dumb line from all the old Western movies? A man's gotta do what a man's gotta do? Well, that goes for women, too.
I don't want us to wind up doing a number with guns, you know?
I didn't mean what I said the other night when I was drunk. About Mr. Goody-Goody. Well, I meant it, but...
You were right, anyway.
As Rourke walked away from Rubenstein and Natalie, he thought how insane the whole thing was. It was the end of the 20th century, and here he was facing off in a 19th century gunfight with a gang of ritualistic murderers and renegades as the spectators, in a world that, for all Rourke knew, could itself have been in the last throes of death. He could see Deke emerging from the crowd itself splitting into two flanks with a clear space behind Rourke and a space clearing behind Deke as well. The blonde man's hair hung in limp curls plastered against his forehead, with pansy blue eyes riveted on Rourke as he moved slowly into position. From the corner of his right eye, Rourke could see Natalie standing close beside Rubenstein, their eyes staring toward him. Rourke shot a glance toward Deke's right hip, then let his eyes drift upward to Deke's eyes. The two men were perhaps 7 yards apart, Rourke gauged. It was the classic shootout distance. Neither man could likely miss on the first shot. The single action Deke had strapped to his thigh with a heavy leather band at the base of the holster would be a .45 long Colt caliber. The bullets themselves weightier than even a hardball .45 ACP load, the round an inherent man-stopper like the .45 ACP was. Deke's blue eyes set hard. The left hand with the glove for fanning was twitching. Rourke dove right, the stainless pistol ripping from the leather. Rourke's shot hit Deke's midsection, punching through the side-turned man's arm and into his gut. The blonde-haired man wheeled, dropping to one knee in the mud, a trickle of blood sliding from the corner of his mouth. Rourke's second hollow point punched dead square between Deke's eyes. Rourke got to his feet, mud dripping from his shirt and Levi's. Natalie was beside him. He could feel her hands on his left arm. Rourke edged Deke's body over with the toe of his boot, and as the body rolled, the revolver fell from the man's gun hand. His head was cracked up the forehead, and the empty eyes just stared up as the rain fell down into them. For a moment, Rourke could do nothing but stare down into them himself. He had kept his promise to the woman with the dead infant. Rourke sat behind the wheel of the pickup truck. Water still dripped from his hair. The girl beside him and Rubenstein on the far passenger side were soaked as well. The gang would be moving out, and now Rourke, Rubenstein, and Natalie were a part of it. One of the outriders had returned in the aftermath of the gunfight with news that the paramils were now closer than Rourke or any of the gang had thought them to be. It was imperative now that they head to safety, and for the time being, they had to put as much distance as possible between themselves and the others. They needed to find a secure site for the battle lines to be drawn. Rourke watched through the windshield as Deke's corpse was lugged away, just as he had watched when the townspeople were released. Wet, dirty, bedraggled, and terrified, they had slunk past the pickup truck, some turning and quickly eyeing Rourke before starting to run as they'd headed out of the circle of trucks, alive. But Rourke had wondered if they were really better off now. The new world that had taken shape after the night of the war was a violent one, and Rourke knew that many of them would not survive. Some would die because they could not cope with the violence. Some would perhaps eventually revel in it and become brigands themselves. Silently, he'd wondered how his own wife and two children were faring. Were they even still alive? For now, the only thing that he was sure of was the pressure of Natalie's hand against his. As soon as they had come to a stop, the gang members had split off into separate smaller groups and set to work constructing a variety of lean-tos and shelters on the lee side of the trailers to get as much protection as possible from the rain. Throughout the day, they had made their way about 60 miles to a plateau. On the drive, it had been hard to judge its height, but the crude road leading up to it had been steep and narrow. All that needed defending was the narrow road itself, and a half-dozen well-armed men could have held the road against 20 times that number of equally well-armed attackers. In fact, as far as Rourke could determine, the area would be virtually impenetrable without air support. After Rourke and his companions had constructed a small lean-to with some tarp up against the side of the pickup truck, Rubenstein had set to work cooking dinner on the Coleman stove.
John, what are we going to do now? It looks like they'll be setting up for a battle as soon as the rain slacks up.
The paramils won't be moving far in this weather. They look less prepared for rough weather than these guys did.
I don't think we're going to see much before this lets up. Probably not for several hours afterwards. I could be wrong. Depends on how tough the paramils are. Hopefully Mike has already put out guards by that road just in case.
We going to try and get out?
We can't, Paul. Not until the battle starts. And if we're still up here, I don't see us getting out then.
Natalie's right. If we're still up here, escaping is going to be next to impossible. We just have to do our duty as good brigand troopers and hope the bad guys win instead of the good guys.
The paramils are good guys?
Well, I admit we had kind of a bad experience with them. But somebody's got to go up against the gangs, and it doesn't look like there's any kind of government left.
What do you think is left?
Probably more of Russia than there is of the U.S. I don't know for certain. Looks like a good deal of the country is going to be uninhabitable for a long time. Look at this weather we're having, too. It's supposed to be hot out here, but I bet the temperature is pushing down to 40 or so. You notice the sunsets? Each night they've been a little redder. All that crap from the bomb blast is getting up into the atmosphere and staying there.
You think we're just going to die, John?
No. Listen, just trust me, because I know something about this. The radiation couldn't have done that much damage. The world is going to survive. I just know it.
I know you know it. And it's not Natalie, is it? At least not in the language you grew up with, right?
Wait, what do you mean, Rourke? Not in the language she grew up with. Wait a second.
Sit down and relax, Paul.
It means I'm Russian.
You're what?
She's one of the top women in the KGB, the Committee for State Security. The Russian version of the CIA and FBI rolled into one.
Russian?
Relax, Rubenstein.
Please, Paul.
What do you mean? And after all we've been through together, after the way you lied to us, we saved your life, lady.
I didn't ask you to come along and find me. I don't mean any harm to either of you. I almost love you both. Please, Paul.
Now, both of you, knock it off.
Knock it off? It's not enough that the Russians have destroyed the world, practically? They killed millions of Americans? Yeah, knock it off. What about you, John? You gonna knock it off? Just because you miss your wife, and you think maybe she's dead, and this one comes along, and she's a knockout, and she's got the hots for you to get into her pants?
I didn't drop any bombs. I didn't give any attack orders, Paul. Leave me alone.
Look. He's right, you're right. You didn't drop any bombs. You were just being a patriotic Russian. And now you're here in this country, and you're looking for Samuel Chambers. What, to kill him? So he doesn't serve as a rallying point for resistance, right?
I'm just doing my damn job, John. It's my job.
I had a job like that once. But you know what I did? I quit. That's where you remembered me from. South America a few years ago. I was down there a lot in those days. I didn't quit because my philosophy changed or anything. I just quit because I wanted to and figured I'd done my time. You could do the same, couldn't you?
I've got other reasons. I believe in what I'm doing.
You didn't see your face when you looked at those refugees, the woman with the dead baby. You're on the wrong side, Natalie. Natalia?
Yes. So is that why you didn't try and kill me when you recognized me?
No, that isn't why.
How long have you known, John?
Long enough. After the first couple of days, I was sure. Natalia, is Karamazov here, too? You always worked with him down south.
Yes.
Who the hell is Karamazov?
He's the best agent in the KGB. At least he thinks so, and everyone tells him that. I guess it doesn't matter. He's in charge of the newly formed American branch of the KGB. He's the top man in your entire country. The only man who can overrule him here is General Varakov. He's the military commander for the North American Army of Occupation.
This is like some kind of a nightmare. During World War II, my aunt was trapped over in Germany when the war broke out. They found out she was Jewish, and they arrested her, and we never heard from her again. I grew up hating the Nazis for what they'd done. What the hell do you think American kids are gonna grow up hating, Natalie? Huh? How many houses and apartment buildings and farms, schools, office buildings, how many places just stopped existing? How many children and women and little dogs and cats and everything else that matters in life did you people kill that night? You guys make Hitler look like some kind of bush leaguer.
This was a war, Paul. We had no choice. The U.S. ultimatum in Afghanistan, there was no choice. No choice. We had to strike first. And then your own president held back U.S. retaliation until the last possible minute. We didn't know.
Do you hear what you're both saying, Paul? Things haven't changed at all since the war, have they?